thing. Okay, well, let's take our Bibles. We're in Psalm 130. Psalm 130. For those who are new to the class, we are attempting to go through the Psalms in a 10-year period. Each summer, we do Psalms in the summer. And our goal is in 10 summers to get through the Psalms, all 150 Psalms, verse by verse. And I think we're going to accomplish that. So now we are in what are known as the Psalms of the Ascent. These were Psalms that were sung as Israel was heading upward toward Jerusalem for some pilgrim feast. And Psalm 130 is the 11th Psalm of Ascent, a psalm that would be sung as they were journeying toward Jerusalem to celebrate one of the feasts. Now, these feasts were very, we got a radio going on here. Let me just hold off for a second. The pilgrim feast involved many temple activities and festivities, and so you'd be there for a week. And so it was a very busy week centered around the temple. And this song reflects the psalmist's need for forgiveness and restoration, okay? So Psalm 130, you'll notice it's 8 verses. It's divided into 2 major sections. Now, we can divide it down more minutely, but the 2 broad sections are verses 1 through 4, where the psalmist speaks to God. He speaks to God. And then verses 5 through 8, the psalmist speaks to God's people, okay? The first half, he speaks to God. The second half, he speaks to God's people. So let's look at this first section where he addresses God. Now, what I want you to notice, it starts off with a plea, okay? We're going to call this the psalmist plea. Look at verse 1. Out of the depths, I have cried to you. See, there's his plea. I have cried to you, O Lord. Now, what you have here is you have one verb there. It's a key verb, and that's the word cry. So this speaks of emotion. This speaks of a cry that's very emotional, moving type of a cry. It's not just I talk to God, but he says that he cried to God. Now, I want you to notice 3 things. Notice what this verse says. First of all, I want you to notice that it is an individual cry. Notice he says, out of the depths, I cried to you. Okay. So this is a prayer, in a sense. And this is something that each one of us can do. We can speak to the Lord on a regular basis. Second of all, notice it's addressed to the Lord, all capitals. Do you see that? Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Now, if you've been with us, you know that this is God's covenant name. When God appeared to Moses and he told Moses to lead his people, Moses said, well, who should I say sent me? And he said, well, tell them that I am sent you, or Yahweh or Jehovah sent you. That is translated all capitals, capital L-O-R-D in our English Bible. This is the God who chose Israel to be his special people and revealed himself to them and entered into a covenant with them. So it's addressed to the Lord. Third, notice it's a cry of anguish. Look at that. Out of the what? Depths. Do you see that? Out of the depths, I cry to you. Now, if I ask you what a depth is, one thing you do know about it, it's something that's deep, right? What kind of depths, you know? Depths of what? Despair. Depths of sorrow. Depths of sickness. Depths of sin. You know, what kind of depths? We don't know what kind of depths. The word depths often refers to the sea. Now, we don't believe he's in the sea, but he's using that kind of imagery. You go down into the depths. And so here is a person that is in the depths of despair, the depths of guilt and sadness or whatever. And we might say that he's in a spiritual sinkhole or in a pit. And he's crying from out of the depths. Now, when you're deep down in the depths, and I don't care whether it's you're deep in sickness or you're deep in sin or you're deep in the ground, when you cry, guess what? Your cry is very faint. Go under the water and cry out for somebody to help you. They're not going to hear that. So he realizes that he's in the depths, and so his cry, he has to cry out with emotion as loud as he can in order to be heard. Depths are a very dangerous place. So we might say that this cry is urgent. He's in a situation that he doesn't want to be. And because he's in the depths, there's only one way to look. And that's up. When you're in the depths, you don't look down. There's only one way to look, and that's up. And sometimes God has to put you in a place where you've absolutely hit rock bottom before you cry out for help. Now, anybody that has been in Alcoholics Anonymous and you've had a drinking problem, you know exactly what I'm talking about. One of the rules is, oftentimes, the spouse of a drunk is told, don't lie for him. Don't say, well, he can't come in today, he's feeling sick. You're not helping him. See, he needs to hit rock bottom before he'll reach out to God. So call up the boss and say, he can't come in today, he's drunk. Yeah, but what happens if he gets fired? Well, he'll get fired. You know, maybe he has to hit rock bottom. And so this is where this person is. This psalmist is either thinking back to a time when he cried out to God and he had hit rock bottom, or he is in that state right now, probably reflecting back. Now look at the content of the cry. So here's what he does. He cries. What does he say? Look what he says in verse 2. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. This is his request. Notice he wants to be heard. You see that? Maybe he feels abandoned. He's asking God to pay attention to him. I'm crying, listen to me! See, that's what he's saying. There's a sense of urgency in this particular passage. He doesn't want an audience, he wants an answer. He knows God sees him. But he doesn't care about God seeing him. He wants God to hear him. He wants God to answer him. And so he uses this human language to describe God. Let your ears be attentive to my voice. God doesn't have ears, does he? God's a spirit. But we imagine God the way we look. And so he is using this human language to describe God. So that's his cry, and that's what he says. Now look at his confidence. If you, Lord, covenant Lord, the one who loves Israel, if you should mark iniquities, O Lord, who can stand? And the answer is obvious. If God marks iniquities, who can stand? And the answer is what? Nobody can stand. Okay? So look at two words there, a couple key words. The word mark, what does it mean? If you should mark iniquities. If you should pay attention, well, God knows that we all sin, you know. What's it mean if you should mark? It means if God would record it permanently on a record that couldn't be erased. If God took out his Sharpie and marked down every time you sin, no one would be able to stand. We'd all just stand guilty before God. Notice the word iniquities. Do you see that? Notice it's plural. This shows you that the psalmist has a sin problem. He's in the depths because of sin, and he says, you know, if God marks these down permanently, no one's going to be able to stand, and I'll be in trouble. But look at the next word, verse 4. It says this, but. Hey, now that's a good word right there. That's the best word in this whole passage. But there's an alternative to God marking down your iniquities in a permanent way. But, he says, there is forgiveness with you, meaning with Yahweh, with Jehovah. He's a covenant God. With God, there's no judgment for the believer. Why not? Because God has entered into this agreement with his people, and he says, anytime you call upon me, you confess your sin, I will answer. See? So If God marks down iniquities, no one can stand. But guess what? He doesn't mark them down for the believer. There is forgiveness with God. He offers forgiveness. And probably the greatest story is the one of the prodigal son. The prodigal son says, I shouldn't even be allowed to come back home and be your son. I should just be a slave. But what does God do? He cries out to his father, and his father brings him back and actually throws a party. That's how God responds to his people, the people that, whom he loves. But if you're outside of the covenant, if you were part of those nations that were not, that were outside of the covenant, the only thing you're going to get for your sin is judgment. See? He that believes is not condemned. He that believeth not is what? Condemned already. The sword is hanging over that person's head and it's ready to fall. So they shall not stand in the day of judgment because God's marked their sin. The only way they're forgiven is to come into the covenant. Okay? So you have these two categories. Those who are in the covenant, whose sins are not marked, they have forgiveness. Now what's the purpose of all this? Look at this. It's very interesting. But there's forgiveness with you, verse 4, with you, God. Watch this. What's the purpose for this forgiveness? That, so that, in order that, you forgive us, in order that you may be feared. Forgiveness leads to fear of God. Now, you wouldn't think that, would you? You would think that the threat of being punished would cause you to fear God. You would think it's just the opposite. But that's not what he says. He says, no, no, no. It's forgiveness. The purpose of forgiveness is that you will fear God. Now that seems, you know, illogical. But when a person is forgiven, there's this sudden realization of God's power, what he could have done instead of forgiving you. And I'll give you an example of this. I was at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., working on my Master Divinity degree. The first week back in my third year of school, I was radically converted. Up until that time, I was lost. But I had an experience where I was converted, radically converted. My whole life changed in a split second. And I remember the next day, I was walking across the campus of the seminary, and suddenly it hit me. Had I died the day before, I would have gone to hell. And I shuddered to think of that circumstance. But guess what? When did I, and suddenly I began to fear God. I feared God after I was forgiven. It was the next day. Before I was converted, I didn't fear God. I do what I want to do. Look, lost people don't fear God. You know when you fear God? It's when you know God. That's when you fear God. When you're forgiven. And I would never forget, I mean, I just thought, man, if I would have died yesterday, I'd have been lost. And I literally began to shake in my boots. So it's very interesting that God's people, God forgives his covenant people in order that they might fear him, realizing that he is a holy and a righteous and a powerful God. And they don't deserve forgiveness, they deserve judgment. And he said, whoa, you know, I fear God. Okay, so that is the psalmist speaking to God. You see that? That's verses 1 through 4. Now, in verses 5 through 8, the psalmist speaks to God's people. Okay? Watch this. Notice how he addresses God in the third person. He speaks of God in the third person. He says this, verse 5, I wait for the Lord. You see that? He's not speaking to God. Now he's speaking to God's people about God, okay? So, if he speaks about himself, that's first person. If he speaks to you, that's second person. If he speaks about a third person like God, that's third person. He's speaking to God's people about God. And here's what he says. My soul waits for the Lord. Now notice that concept that he's waiting for the Lord. waiting for the Lord to do what? Probably to forgive him and get him out of this ditch that he's in. Say, so he's waiting on the Lord to respond. Now, to wait for the Lord means you're waiting in faith. You're trusting that he indeed is going to respond, okay? So oftentimes that takes patience. If he's waiting for the Lord, he anticipates that the Lord is going to respond. If he's waiting for the Lord in faith, he expects the Lord to respond, see? But sometimes that takes patience. Now, how long must he wait for the Lord to get him out of this mess? How long must he wait? As long as it takes. How long did Job have to wait? He had to wait a long time, didn't he? What's it called? The patience of Job? You see, it's taken you a long time to get down in that depth. To mess your life up as bad as you messed it up. And isn't it interesting? We want God just stuff like this. Bop, 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 bop. Everything's fine. Hunky-dory. No. Sometimes God allows you to stay down there until you're really desperate. And so he's waiting on the Lord, you see. How long? As long as it takes. He must never give up. His faith must endure in this covenant God. God, I trust you to get me out of this. You must be vigilant, you see. So look what he says. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits. And then he says this. In his word, I do hope. Okay, so now you have, I wait. My soul waits, two waits, and I hope, one hope. So notice his waiting is hopeful waiting. He's anticipating God to do something. But what's the basis of the hope? What's it say there in verse 5? In his what do I hope? In his word, you see that? In his word I do hope. What word? What word is he depending on? The covenant word that God gave to his people. That if you do this, I will do that. So he's just waiting for God to do and fulfill his part of the bargain. Does that make sense? Look at verse 6. My soul waits for the Lord. So again, we have him reiterating that. So notice how many times wait is in there. So sometimes we just have to wait on the Lord, and we don't get immediate answers. Although he knows God's going to forgive him, he knows God's going to deliver him, he's going to have to wait, okay? To what degree? Can you compare it to anything? What is the intensity of the waiting, if you want to use that? So look what he says. My soul waits for the Lord. It simply means I wait for the Lord. More than those who watch for the morning. I wait for the Lord more than those who watch for the morning. Yes, more than those who watch for the morning. He repeats it twice, doesn't he? So he is waiting more with an intensity, a longing, more than those who wait for the morning. Now, who in the world is he talking about? He's talking about watchmen. The watchmen of Israel who sit on the wall of Israel. And they're watching out across the desert. They're looking into the distance to see if anybody's approaching the city, whether they're friend or foe. Now, you know, to be a watchman, we're not talking about a night watchman like the people work today and they sleep on the job. This was an important job because Israel was always in danger of attack. And you had to know who the people were who were approaching the city. For a watchman, the worst time to watch was at night. Why do you think that was? Because you can't see at night. It's dark. And so the watchman is watching at night. And you know, it's so difficult to look out there and see who's coming or if anybody's coming. If that shadow, a person coming? Is that an army coming? You know, it's so difficult. And so the one thing that the watchman longed for was the sun to come up. Because then he could see better, more clearly, and allow him to discern who's approaching the city, if anybody. So every watchman anxiously waits for the sunrise, if they can only make it through the night, you know. So the psalmist is in the depths of darkness, and he knows that God's going to answer. But he has to wait, just like a watchman waits, even more than the watchman waits. He's sure that God will answer and that the sun will rise and then everything will be clear. That's his hope. And that's the intensity of his waiting. So he affirms that God's going to answer and he waits on the Lord in faith. Does that make sense? He's speaking to God's people about that. He's saying, that's what I have to do. See? Now, these verses 7 and 8, it sort of takes a turn. He's still speaking to God's people, but now he exhorts them. He exhorts Israel, okay, to do something. Look what he says in verse 7. O Israel, speaks to the nation. Look what you need to do. Hope in the Lord. Just as I need to hope in the Lord and in his word as an individual. So Israel as a nation needs to hope in the Lord. Okay? What's the basis for that hope? Look what it says. O Israel, hope in the Lord. Here's the reason for the hope. You need to hope in the Lord for or because with the Lord there is what? Mercy. Israel has messed up so many times, and guess what? They get themselves in trouble. And they too, like the individual, needs to hope in the Lord because the Lord extends mercy. Now, the word mercy there is that covenant word that we've talked about so many times. It's compassion. With the Lord, there's compassion. There is loving kindness. There's covenant love for these people. He has entered into this agreement. He has said, if you cry out to me and you repent, I will be merciful to you. I will show you my compassion. I will not give you judgment. So we are, the nation is to cry out to the Lord and hope in the Lord. Reason number one, for with the Lord there is mercy. And reason number two, and with him is abundant redemption. There's enough to go around for everybody, even an entire nation. See? Redemption means freedom. Redemption means liberty. Redemption means to remove out of slavery. With God, he can even redeem a nation. Can you think of a time when God redeemed Israel? Yeah, the Exodus, right? Just redeemed them. Okay? He's redeemed them many times. He delivered them from the Babylonians. See? And so he says, you know, and God can do it more than once because with him there's an abundance of redemption. But we must always come back to God. We must always hope. We must always throw ourselves upon the mercy of God. God can bring a nation out of the pit, the same as he can a person out of the pit. And then he gives this promise. Look what he says. And he shall redeem Israel. Look at that. Hope in it. Believe in his mercy. Depend on his mercy. And he shall redeem Israel. He gives the nation assurance and confidence that they too will be set free, even from future invaders. And look, we know when the New Testament's written, the Jews are under bondage once again, aren't they, in Rome? But guess what? Even in that situation, there is abundant redemption, and he can deliver them from anybody who oppresses them. And with him, there's abundant redemption, and he shall redeem Israel. Every act of deliverance is simply a preview that points to the final deliverance on the day of judgment. And this is the reason we know that God will redeem us as well. So, this is a psalm or a song that was being sung by the psalmist, and maybe there was a response by the people that were marching along as they were heading toward Jerusalem for a pilgrim feast. This feast will end at the temple gate. They will go through the gates of the city, and they will go into the temple where they offer their sacrifices, and God will gladly receive the sacrifices and provide them forgiveness of sins and redemption once more, if they pledge their allegiance to the Lord. Always predicated on the fact that you need to repent of your sin and you need to pledge your allegiance to the Lord. Now, let me just make some sort of equivalency for today, okay? In the Old Testament, the covenant people of God were the Jews. The Jews were God's people based on a covenant, an agreement. Okay? In the New Testament, the believers in Jesus are the people of God. Whether Jew or Gentile, if they believe in God, they believe in Jesus, like the Apostle Paul believed in Jesus, Peter believed in Jesus, they were Jews. Or if it's a centurion, who's a Gentile, who believes in Jesus, they are now part of the people of God under a new covenant. Pastor talked about the new covenant today. Remember, we had the Lord's Supper, and Jesus raised the cup, and he said, this is the blood of the what? New covenant given for you. So, Old Testament people of God were Jews under the Old Covenant, New Testament, those who believe in Jesus, Jew or Gentile, under the New Covenant. Just as God wrote a covenant or an agreement with the people of Israel, so he has written an agreement with us, okay? In the Old Testament, Israel was the holy nation. Israel was God's treasure. In the New Testament, it's the church that's called a holy nation, a peculiar treasure, a special people. The church is a nation. It doesn't seem like we're a nation, but we are. All under the reign of a king called King Jesus. That's how Peter, that's how Paul saw the church, as God's nation or God's kingdom. We need to be careful that we don't equate America with Israel. Okay? America is not Israel. Great Britain is not Israel. No nation, no secular nation is the equivalent of Israel. We have not, as a nation, entered into the covenant of the blood of Jesus Christ. It's the church who is the holy nation that has entered into the covenant with Jesus Christ. And because of that, those of us who are believers and churches, wherever they're found, in America, Russia, Cuba, doesn't matter where the churches are found, they too are part of this nation of God. They are the people of God. And these promises that we find in Psalm 130 apply to us, you see. This is our song. I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore. And what happens? Love lifted me. God's compassionate love lifted me. See, we are the ones that were sinking. Jesus lifts us up and offers us forgiveness and mercy. Okay, now next week, here's where we're going. What you notice next week, Psalm 131, how many verses? Three, okay? Then I want you to notice 133, how many verses? Three. And then look at 134, how many verses? Three. Okay, we're going to do that next week, okay? We're going to do 3, 3, and 3 and get that out of the way. That's not a good way of handling the Bible. That out of the way. And then the following week, we'll come back and we'll do Psalm 132, which is 18 verses. And then that will end our ninth year of Psalms in the summer. And then the Lord willing, we're going to finish up the Psalms in our 10th year, 2018. Now, I asked a question a number of weeks ago. I said, how many people were here when we started the Psalms 9 years ago? I want you to see that again. Look at that. And I said, do you think you can stick around for 10 years on this? You know, don't die on me, you know, things like that. But, you know, it's all that's in God's hands. But this, for those of us who have been through the Psalms, hopefully this will be a blessing for you.